You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap Genius.
I see images of my mom, like, being arrested by police, holding her fist up, singing, you know? You see images of Pac's mom strapped in a black beret, you know, swinging.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we bring you the first in a special two-part series about the new Broadway musical, Holler If You Hear Me, which features the songs of rap icon Tupac Shakur. This week, we have the show's star, the poet, writer, performer, and actor Saul Williams. Saul is actually a repeat guest on Outside the Lines. If you haven't heard his first show, where we talked about his life and work, you've got to check it out. His accomplishments are many and varied. He wrote and starred in the hit film Slam. He's made incredible albums with producers like Rick Rubin and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. Has a bunch of best-selling poetry books, and now he adds Broadway star to his resume. In this interview, conducted the day before the show's opening, outside a coffee shop in Washington Heights, thus the occasional street sounds, we talk about Pac's legacy, the show, and Saul's long and varied acting career, going all the way back to his first role in third grade. To start the interview, I asked him about several Pac lyrics. The first one, from Thug's Mansion. How can I be peaceful when I'm coming from the bottom? Watch my daddy scream peace while another man shot him. The lyric actually plays a vital role in the story of the play. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you a special kind of audio footnote. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius.
Go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL71. There, you'll find audio, video, and more information to bring you further outside the lines. And now, here's Saul Williams talking about Holler If You Hear Me. The first one I thought, just because like it plays so heavily into the show, is the thing in Thug's Mansion. Say, how can I be peaceful? I'm coming from the bottom. Watch my daddy scream peace while another man shot him.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Right? It starts like that. Of course, what's great about that line, as Pac wrote it, is that he wrote it as fiction. You know? Pac wrote beautiful, rugged, really gully fiction. Like Kool G Rap, you know, like Scorsese and Coppola and Brian De Palma, you know? And of course, the irony was that coming out of his mouth, unlike Brian De Palma's camera, what have you, there was always this quick question of, is he for real? And could this be what led to these murders and blah, 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 blah? But Pac raises a real question, which I feel is extremely sincere, which is, if you are exposed to great levels of violence and poverty, if it's what you know, you haven't been exposed to much more, you've seen crackheads and ministers and, you know, and all that fall in between, and you see people trying to make good choices and fall into the wayside, how can you really be expected to even know how to make informed choices? you know? And so, and then people have these expectations of you of like being peaceful, you know? He has that other line in Holler If You Hear Me, which is like, I guess because I'm black born, I'm supposed to say peace, sing songs, get capped on. Like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I'm black, I'm supposed to be all about peace, and which is, you know, like, you know, there's, of course, we know there are many sides to the movement here. You know, there was the nonviolent side and the side that was like, yo, stand your ground. You know, Malcolm X was stand your ground. Dr. King was stand your ground. And then had a crazy experiment, you know, inspired by Gandhi of like, yo, let's try this. But you read his letters from Birmingham, he's like, I'm saying turn the other cheek and nonviolence, but there's other cats saying other stuff, and what they're saying is valid. So it's safer for you if you try to go with what I'm saying and what with this experiment. Pac came from, you know, unlike me, my parents came from that, you know, the SCLC, from the nonviolent side of the struggle. You see images of my mom, like, being arrested by police, holding her fist up, singing, you know? You see images of Pac's mom strapped in a black beret, you know, swinging, you know? And that's the difference, is that essentially that type of hostility is fully justified, and it's a valid question. How can I be peaceful? How can you expect me to be peaceful when I have no examples of peace working in my life? I have no working examples to go from. And even what you consider peaceful is violent. People consider religion and religious doctrine peaceful, but it's behind like the majority of the wars and genocides that have happened on this planet. And it's been used to indoctrinate and, you know, impose, you know, a sort of subjugation on groups of people at large. History, you know, slavery is just one example of many, you know. When I say slavery, I mean slavery as it happened, you know, the enslavement of Africans. We can talk about the enslavement of Jews. We can, you know, like there's so much. We talk about the Armenian genocide, all these things which had like the ideas of religion and religious right around it, you know. So we have really fucked and skewed examples of peace and peacefulness. So yeah, how can he be peaceful? How can you? Of course, there's a great answer, you know. Of course, there's always a wing and a prayer. Of course, there, you know, at the end of the day, Pac was a peaceful person. You listen to the majority of, you know, not even the majority, you don't have to listen to the majority of his work. Look at the amount of work that he did. Every stroke of the pen was proof that he wasn't clicking a gun. You know what I'm saying? Like, he wrote a lot. He wrote a hell of a lot. He thought a lot. He dreamt a lot. He read a lot. All those are actions of nonviolence. You know? Every time that you spend writing, reading, dialogue, you know, conversing, what have you, those are all nonviolent acts, you know. The majority of his, you know, his 10,000 hours were heavily invested in nonviolence. But yeah, it's a valid question for those of us that have been exposed to great hardships. And if it's all we know, how can you expect us to not act accordingly?
Wow. And I ain't mad at you. I was curious about, like, both the original song and how it's divided in the show. There's the end of, I think it's the first verse, you know, don't even trip because I'm just laughing at you. You're trying hard to maintain, then go ahead because I ain't mad at you. And I talked to Todd about it, about the balance of, like, sarcasm and actual affection in those lines and in the songs. I'll talk about that.
Well, in the context of the play, I think Todd did a brilliant job of allotting different verses and ideas to different characters, so that all of the many voices of Pac kind of came to life in a much more measured way. Because we could say, ah, this Pac belongs to this character. We make that whole idea of Pac, every time he voices anything that belongs to that sensibility, it belongs to that character. And so you split it up amongst 20 people, and all of a sudden you have a really clearer vision of what Pac is saying and what he's expressing. And I Ain't Mad at You in the play, you know, we're really, we have this love triangle, you know, where my character's been in prison, my boy Virtus has not been in prison, and while I've been away, he's ended up getting with my girl, who I thought was waiting for me, and it turns out is with him. And things would probably end up much harsher in the play if the play did not begin with his younger brother being murdered, which kind of softens all of us and makes us deal with the situation as opposed to act out in some kind of crazy way. I guess there's an animosity between these two characters. One, because me, I just, you know, I'm having difficulty accepting that he's with my girl. That's it. For him, I'm someone that he looks up to. He wants me to understand that he didn't plan it. Of course, if you've ever been in that situation, you know, you don't give a fuck about whether they planned it or not. It happened, and it's happening. I don't care about the details. The details are the last thing I want, actually. You know? So, it's interesting. So the way that I Ain't Mad at You works between us is like, on one hand, I am mad at him for what he's done in regards to the girl. But in terms of his life choices, being out, selling rocks, whatever he's doing, I have no judgment on that. And we touch on that later on in another scene where it's like, you know, the scene with the guy Griffey, where he's like, oh, let these kids kill each other. And I'm like, didn't your mom teach you not to judge anybody? Let the rest of us live in peace? You know, it's a bit too simple to think that these guys are just picking up guns because they're angry and not to think of the role that, you know, that even the government itself has played, you know, in the actions that we play and play out. You know, I had this thought the other day when I was thinking about, you know, bullshit rappers that give, like, you know, lessons on hell, how to, like, sell crap, cocaine or what have you. And I'm like, really? It's like you're an ambassador for the FBI right now. Like, the FBI put that shit in the community, or the CIA, both, you know, like, we know now the role that the CIA played with the Contras in order to allow crack and cocaine to enter our communities in the 80s. So the cats were on and on bragging about what they did, were really working for the CIA, even if they had no deals with them. Your average crack dealer bought into the system, and if they were selling and making money like that, then they're working for the system. So it's not hot, it's not cool, it's not fresh in any way. Really, it's like being a snitch, you know? And it's not to say, you know, and what's interesting about Pac is like, you need to clean that shit up. I don't have judgment. Of course, we have the choices that we have to make. It's an easy way to make money. That's what's there for us. But at the same time, Pac was not ignorant to the fact that these things were planted there by the government in the same way that, you know, they planted people inside of the Panthers and the US organization in order to create the Bloods and Crips. And it was them who pitted the Bloods and Crips against each other. And it was them who then put these drugs in the community so that you're playing into their hands. And then when you try to school people on how to do like you, it's a bit misinformed. So the song itself, I Am Mad at You, and the connection between what Pac is saying and what's happening in the play, I think has a lot to do with, like, because my character is like, yo, I understand what you're doing. I see what you're out there doing. But I already got, you know, 2 felonies. Prison was not the shit. As much as people want to act like, you know, oh, I'm authentic now because I have this, you know, accreditation of having been in prison. Fuck that. It was hell. It was not cool. It was bullshit. It's the same thing Pac said, you know. I'm not I have no more time to play these games. I am mad at you for making the decisions that you want to make because people have to learn on their own and by themselves. Like, I can tell you whatever I want to tell you, but you're not going to really hear me until you come up with it on your own, unfortunately. So go ahead and go through the motions. I'll be waiting for you on the other side. I ain't mad at you.
Jumping to something you said in there for 1 second, I wanted to ask you, jumping outside of lyrics for a second, that scene that you were talking about where the garage owner says, you know, oh, why don't they all get guns and kill each other? I wanted to talk about that for a second because I thought it was it was so brief, but it was such an accurate portrayal of a certain kind of racism.
Mentality, yeah.
You know,
I wouldn't call it racism. I'm careful with the usage of that word because, one, I don't believe race exists, but it's something that we practice, particularly in America, and then spread out from here across the world, but particularly here in America. And I'm careful about labeling that racism. It's just a form of not thinking something through. Racism stems from fear and ignorance, you know? And if you're in a position where you don't have to think about something or think too deeply about something, then why would you? Then why would you? It's not because you're racist. It's just because, well, shit, I never had to think about it that deeply. So, you know? But of course, that type of obliviousness is annoying to people on the other side who have no choice. You know, like, because of my complexion, there's a certain predilection that's been forced upon me. You know, I used to live in Brazil when I was 16. I'd walk into a store as a tourist. And as soon as I'd walk in, the shop owners would go, and push me, like get out, like I was a homeless person entering. And I'd go, excuse me, in English. And they'd go, oh, sorry, welcome. Yes, where are you from? You know, because if I was black Brazilian, they would automatically assume, practically know that I was poor. But as a black American, American means rich to them there, you know, when I was living there at the time. And the similar things happen here, you know, how many, you know, like you've heard the countless stories of walking by cars and seeing, you know, or someone clutching their purse or what have you. And I'm like, dude, if you looked at me on paper right now, you probably would not be thinking these things. But judging by the way I look, I get it. Well, I think that Griffey is a really important character in the play. One, because we're on Broadway, the audiences are diverse, and everyone is always looking for the character that they relate to, who they see what's happening through. They see things through their eyes. So I think the little that Griffey has to say is crucial because there's a lot of people there who are like, yeah, I'm thinking the same thing, which then puts my character in the position to say, and this is why what you're thinking is fucked up. And this is how you haven't thought it through. And this is, you know, the sort of judgment and misinformation that you've operated off of. This is how it feeds into the system, to the point where it boils over and ends up being labeled as racism.
Interesting. And one final lyric thing. You know, you closed the first act, or at least you did when I saw the previews, with the title song, with Holler If You Hear Me.
Yeah.
And there's that line in there about, I won't turn the other cheek in case you can't see us while we burn the other week. And it's, yeah, you know, you can talk about that.
Well, that's back to that, you know, coming from the bottom, that Panther perspective of just like, don't come at me with this Judeo-Christian, you know, turn the other cheek, forgive. Really? Why should I? Why would I? What have you, you know, like even the most, you know, I mean, you read the stuff about the fundamentalist Christian ministers in Uganda preaching and teaching hate, and how that spills over into these anti-gay laws, you know, now running rampant throughout the continent of Africa. And you look at the role that religion has played, and you question whether religion has actually done more harm than good. Yesterday, I was thinking, I was like, wow, if all the prisons were churches, or if all the churches were prisons, we'd still have the question of, like, why are there so many? Why are there so many? You know? Essentially, I believe that, you know, religion is a beautiful crutch to help you stand upright in your understanding of humanity and love. But at some point, like if you break a leg or an arm or something, your doctor says, okay, at this point, if you want the musculature to develop properly, you need to take the cast off and practice walking without crutches, or else you'll always be dependent on that crutch. And actually the power that you have, the musculation and all that, is inside of you. You can develop it. This was just a tool that was there to help you stand upright. Now go ahead and stand, you know? So, but then, you know, Huey Newton said something beautiful about God and religion, which was that, you know, it was like, if, you know, in the world, he's like, in the conception of the invisible and invisible forces, you know, there's room for God. You know, here's someone that's a true revolutionary that's like not trying to X out, you know, the existence of God or anything like that. It's just a matter of saying that, you know, the way in which, you know, like if you go back to Out If You Hear Me, no, I won't turn the other cheek. Okay, Jesus set an example. Jesus was born to, you know, well, his mom got, he had a stepdad, right? And the whole nine, and it was rough. It was rough for a Jew in the streets, you know, at that time. You know, it was rough in Palestine and fuck, you know, in Egypt, you know, like, shit wasn't going down too heavy. They were occupied, you know. The 5-0 were out. Roman soldiers were fucking with them all the time. It was stop and frisk in Bethlehem, you know what I'm saying, in Nazareth. Like, it wasn't cool, you know. And he didn't have much choices. Like, you know, it was basically like chopping wood or building sandals and shit, you know what I'm saying? Like, not much a nigga could do. So, you know, there's those similarities, you know. He chose, through his own power, because he was a wordsmith and what have you, to go against the system in the way that he did. But, I mean, actually, the first system that he went up against was the Jewish system. You know, like, why are you doing this on the Sabbath? It's like, why are you practicing stupid laws that were written 1,000 years ago? If some mule falls into a hole on the Sabbath, I can't lift it out on the Sabbath because that's work? Do what the fuck you need to do. Use common sense. Treat people like you want to be treated. That's common sense. Calm the fuck down, get away from the ritual, and practice shit in your daily life that makes fucking sense. Right? Turning the other cheek in Tupac's situation and in many young men's situation who are in, you know, this shit where the police is against them, the government is against them, the prison system is full of them. Why the fuck would you turn the other cheek when turning the other cheek has only brought about more fucking fucked up situations? So it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And in the context of what's happening in that play at that moment, where this guy has gotten out of prison, you know how hard it is to get a job and you get out of prison? Shit, you know how hard it is to get a job and you get out of college? Try getting a job and you get out of prison. All right? Who the fuck wants to hire you? Then you get there, you do your shit, and people are operating with judgment around you all the fucking time. You know, in the play, the guy compares him to the guy that killed Benny. My character went to prison for avenging the death of my father. So it's not to say that I was out there just shooting motherfuckers randomly, you know? But Benny was shot pretty randomly on some real block shit, you know? That's not even what I did. So I feel my character's Griffey's character's judgment of John in that moment. And it's absurd. He can make the connection, but there's really no connection to be made in the mentality of the guy who's like just out there trying to protect his family, you know? So when you feel judged, and it's not just a matter of feeling judged, you know that you are. You know that you're working on a particular level, but there's a glass ceiling and they don't want to pay you for your work. You know, women face that on a regular basis. you know? All sorts of people face that on a regular basis. Then at some point, yeah, it's time to hold motherfuckers accountable.
And about, you know, so I was thinking about Pac and you in the show, and you guys are both, you have some similarities in that you were both heavily into drama, you know, growing up, and, you know, were rappers. And so I was thinking about, like, looking so closely at Pac's stuff like you had to do, do you think that his drama sort of training, his acting was reflected in his writing and his songs?
100%. You know, Pac had a huge love for Shakespeare, which is what I had as a kid. You know, anytime I was in the car or on a weekend, late at night when I couldn't sleep, I would read Shakespeare plays. Call it nerdy, call it what you will. I found it, you know, full of drama. I loved the play on words and the language. I didn't realize what it was feeding into in myself. You know, I just thought it was cool. I thought it was cool. I read the Bible too. And then I discovered Shakespeare, and Shakespeare was more fun, you know? And what's interesting is that, you know, for Pac, he says that he discovered poetry first, and that sparked his interest in hip-hop. I discovered hip-hop first, and that sparked my interest in poetry, you know? But yeah, in the same way, you know, Pac is painting pictures, and not only painting pictures, but like holding pictures in his head from real experience. As Pac goes on, his stuff becomes less fictitious, but the imagery is still there. So that when he's speaking directly to prisoners and he's like, when they turn out the lights, I'll be there in the dark. He knows very well what happens when they turn out the lights in the prison. And it's fucking crazy. Like when we shot Slam, we shot it in DC jail. And I spent a lot of time in the wards there, especially in the juvenile ward. With no exaggeration, out of the like maybe 30 cells that I went into, 28 of them would have a picture of Pac in there. And maybe like an orange or an apple, a rosary hanging, like a makeshift altar for Pac in there. Because what other rapper was speaking directly to them? Speaking direct, I hear you. I hear you when you're crying. I see, you know, I see what you're going through. Don't worry. You know, see you when I free you. Or if not, when they shove me in. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, Pac, you know, like, of course Pac had flaws, you know? If I were to guess at what that might be, it's his temper. He saw red, you know? When you see red, when you get angry, it's like, well, fuck it, you know? I know lots of people like that. I know women like that. I know lots of people like that who just get angry. And when they're angry, it's like, everything comes out. It's all is lost and fuck everything, you know? I'm not necessarily built that way, you know? But I get it. I get it. But the majority of Pac's work spoke to a much deeper passion, something much deeper than anger, you know? He felt a true compassion for his community, for the country. What's crazy is that, you know, Pac, as someone whose parents were directly, you know, were labeled terrorists by the American government, whose aunt is still labeled a terrorist, is on the most wanted list, Assata Shakur.
Right, it's still, you know, political football.
It's still, yeah, you know, political football right now. It's still that bullshit of the state of New Jersey, you know, making sure that they raise the bounty up to $2 million, you know, for her, and she's in political asylum in Cuba for a crime that is practically impossible for her to commit. You know, like, she supposedly shot a police officer after she had already been shot 2 times underneath each arm, so then she lifted up a gun and shot this cop. Okay. Okay. You know? When is the FBI gonna admit to how much intelligence they've thwarted in this country? you know? When is our own government going to admit to that? Until then, I would say, fuck turning every cheek. Go at them. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was so glad to see that the CIA and the FBI and the defense team, defense department started Twitter handles, you know? I started sending them fucking Public Enemy videos. I sent them Black Steel in the Hour of Chaos. Like, yo, check it out. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? It's nice to have a way to reach out to them, you know? Because it's no joke.
Rap G's.
And it's easy for us, you know, who grew up in privilege, who grew up in middle class families, who go to great schools and have startups and websites and careers and theater and all that stuff, to be like, oh yeah, these problems out here, it's too bad. It's just too bad. But there are real consequences to these problems. Look at the statistics, you know? Like, I read something the other day about like what the prison statistics were for Black men when Pac was alive versus what it is now. It's gone up 300%. And supposedly things are getting better in the land of the free, where there's more prisoners than any other country on this planet. Obviously, something's wrong. And we go on and on about, you know, right-wing extremists and other religions and refuse to admit the sort of religious fundamentalism that our country is operating off of and how it's used to trick us and to, you know, how we operate off of fear and how, you know, the FBI to this day creates stings in certain communities, you know, so that they can pump up fear and the idea of terrorism or homegrown terrorism. There's a documentary I saw recently about the city I'm from, Newburgh, New York. There's a documentary coming out called The Newburgh Sting. About just that. It's coming out on HBO this summer. About just that, how the FBI set up some local cats as homegrown terrorists. And these cats, you know, could give a fuck. They're just trying to get money. So if an FBI operative is like, yo, I'll give you $300,000 to point this gun at a plane, it's not like, I don't give a fuck. You'll give me what? I mean, if we're running like that, you're going to have a lot of fucking homegrown terrorists. You know what I'm saying? You know, we need to treat some of these TV producers as homegrown terrorists, some of these music producers and labels as homegrown terrorists for the bullshit they're funneling into the system.
Rap G's.
You know? I don't even know what question I'm responding to anymore.
No, it's all incredible. I've started, you know, talking about Pac and sort of his relationship to drama.
And drama. So Pac did A Raisin in the Sun when he was 12. Pac's mother read him poetry all the time. And Pac loved it. Pac was a sweet kid. Pac, when he was 17, was in love with the head of the Communist Party's, the Young Revolutionary Party's daughter. And that was his girlfriend, you know? He joined the Young Communist Party and all this stuff. He and her daughter. You can see that it's cute. It's really cute. And for me, it's true. I grew up, you know, in the suburbs. My dad was a pastor. My mom was a teacher. The hood I grew up in was crazy, but I had a very Good Will Hunting experience, you know, of everybody basically just looking out for me, and everybody knew me because my dad preached everybody's funeral. Real simple. You know?
Best way to get known, I guess.
Best way to get known. Died, oh, right? Yeah. Everybody. They had shootouts at my school, at my junior high school, with Uzis. I thought that was normal. I didn't know that wasn't happening in every school in America. I thought that was just the shit we face, you know? Either way, drama for me, and I think for Pac too, was a way of traveling when I didn't have opportunities to travel. I could, you know, travel into the mind state of another character who lives in another country, has a different experience, and explore in that way. And so I had my first taste of the world outside of my house and my family through drama, you know? I got to play a Roman soldier. Imagine that, you know, when I did Julius Caesar. I got to play a young Italian kid when I played Romeo and Romeo and Juliet. Or I got to play a British, you know, not orphan, but schoolmaster when I did Oliver Twist. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. All these little things. You know, okay, I'm in England. I'd never been to England. I'd never been to Rome. I'd never been, you know.
Well, how old were you when you started acting in shows? Like, what's third the first
grade.
Role you remember?
Third grade. Third grade, I did Julius Caesar. I played Mark Antony. Fourth grade, I did Romeo and Juliet. And I'll never forget that because at the end of third grade, the drama teacher was like, we thought he was great. And next year, we want to do Romeo and Juliet. But I'm telling you now that the only way we'll do it is if you agree right now to play Romeo, because we don't know what other student would be able to do it. And so me and my best friend, Keisha Gordon, were cast as Romeo and Juliet in third grade for the fourth grade production. You know? And then after that, we did Oliver Twist in fifth grade. Sixth grade is when I started taking acting class. They did something in sixth grade that was more women-centered. I don't remember what it was. I wasn't in the production. I just worked backstage. But that's when I started doing acting school at HB Studios in the West Village. And
so you were commuting from Newburgh to the city.
Yep. Getting on the train at
12,
Beacon.
13 years
riding
old.
My bike to the Beacon, to the empty city, the empty, decrepit city of Beacon, which is now, you know, I used to be like, I'm from Newburgh, and maybe, you know, 1 out of 100 people would know of Newburgh, and no one would know Beacon. Now, everybody knows Beacon. No one knows Newburgh.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess upstate is kind of funny that way. You're just, people from here obviously think of upstate as anything, you know, north of where we are right now, basically.
Well, upstate is like New York State's best kept secret. It's so beautiful. I didn't appreciate it as a kid because I just wanted to be in the city. Especially being that close to the city, we were in the city every week, and it's the only place I wanted to be, you know? So I could hear, you know, Red Alert and Molly Mall more clearly, like, because we listened to Newburgh. It was the last place probably where you could get New York radio, but with a little bit of static, you had to, like, move to the right. It's like, oh, here it is. It's clear here, you know? So I could get the record the master mix, you
right.
know, on Friday and Saturday.
Amazing. And so at what point did you start thinking, like, hey, I like hip-hop, I like theater. How can those things go together?
Immediately. So in third grade is the same year I started rapping. Because that's the year that Tila Rock, It's Yours came out. And that made me want to rhyme. And so I was studying Shakespeare that year. I had a class called Shake Hands with Shakespeare. And I started studying French that year. So that year, I started writing rhymes in Old English and in French. See, yeah, of course. I'm just trying to use everything that I know. I'm 9 years old, 8 years old. I know a little bit. I've learned some Old English. I think it's fascinating. So I'm like, well, if thou shouldest come to my street today, you will find, you know. I was always trying to blend it. When I moved to Brazil when I was 16, I started writing what I called a hip hopra, which I then saw the term coined maybe 10 years later.
I was going to say, I feel like I've seen one or two shows
yeah.
only, you know, recently.
Yeah, but I tried doing that when I was 16, and I tried to write, because I was always into musicals. I always came to the theater, and I liked them on film as well. Mary Poppins, even as an adult, I thought was brilliant. And Jesus Christ Superstar, even take away all the religious shit, the performances and the songwriting was out of this world. It's the role of Judas that stands out, actually, that's amazing in the film, Jesus Christ Superstar. And so I tried to write a hip-hop version of Jesus Christ Superstar when I was in Brazil. And the idea was to do kind of a jukebox musical. I remember one scene, which was the Sermon on the Mount, Blessed Are the So-and-Sos, and the people like catch the Holy Spirit and start speaking in tongues. And so I used rock bass and easy rock because I imagined Jesus speaking and the people catching the Spirit and going, woo, yeah, woo, yeah. Like one by one, people waking up, woo. Yeah!
Rap G's.
So it's going to be a jukebox musical, yeah. But I was jumping around to like Public Enemy, Rakim, LL, Run-D. I had them all in, you know, that style of rhyming. I was learning a lot from, like, I would really break down rhymes. Like, I really liked the style of rhyming that that Run did, because he always put, you know, I forget what you call that, you know. I never studied poetry, so I learned from my daughter when she asked me questions that she thinks I should know, because she's studying poetry in high school, and she's like, they said it needs to be an ABA format, and I'm like, yeah. Like, but you're, I'm like, yeah, but I'm not 100% sure, you know, but I would say that, like, I knew all of that stuff without knowing how they were officially labeled. So what I liked about Run was that he would be like, I'm devastating, captivating, one of a kind, no effects in the blacks, make you lose your mind, and a blah da 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 and a kata tinta kata t, you know? And so I would always try to do, like, those double rhymes within the rhyme format. Some, you know, poetry student is going to say, oh, he's talking about the such and such format. Correct.
Rap G's.
you know, but yeah, I always try. That's what I loved about Run. Everybody had, you know, for LL, I loved his braggadocio. You know, he had the braggadocio that predated Nas when he was, you know, because Nas blew all of our minds away when he was like, when I was 12, I went to hell for snuffing Jesus, you know, like kidnapped the president's wife without a plan, or before stepping to me, you rather step to Jehovah. For a young teenager to say that at that time, it was like, holy fuck, how do you think of that? That's the shit, you know? But that's 93. I'm talking about before that when I'm writing the hip hop opera in 88, 89. That's the year I'm in Brazil, and for that school year. And yeah, so.
LL's braggadocio is really something. I always think of I'm Bad, especially. Like the my vocals exact, like rack and pinion and a jag. There's just something so.
But come on, you can go before that. His first album when he's like, I'm not a virgin, but I know I make Madonna scream. And the next line is created Michael and Prince. He said he created Michael and Prince. I'm not a virgin, so I know I make Madonna scream, created Michael and Prince. Like, the fuck? He's 16 talking about he created Michael and Prince. No, no one could brag like, oh, that was crazy. You know, now we listen to it like, oh, that's old school. But what we have to realize is that no one had done it before. This was completely original. It's something that, like, you'll never understand if you grow up on Gaga or, you know, anybody else, because they're rehashing ideas that are cool. I'm not dissing them, but it's completely different to be at the forefront of an art form as it's being created and to step out on a limb when it's never been done before. And Pop came early enough in the game. I mean, his first album came out in 91. Where I also think that he innovated a few MC styles, you know?
How do you mean?
I mean, like, for instance, his flow on Resist the Temptation is sick. The first verse, the Resist the Temptation of the Streets, I can't think of the word. I just know that that right at the point where he goes, oh, and how it hurts. Resist the curbs. And then the church, and the brother sinner can it benefit the perks. And like the way that he's riding that, I'm not certain anybody did that before. Like, it's just crazy what he does on that first album. I've read some articles where, like, oh, we like the figure of Tupac, but as an MC, blah, 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 blah.
Kind of a standard thing to say about him or whatever.
Fuck that. I'm certain that those are just people who don't really get what it takes to write the way he did, you know? It's like the same mistake people would make. They don't make it as much with Eminem, you know? And all the irony in there is what it is. But, you know, like, you listen to Eminem's Stan song, which I think is one of the most brilliantly written songs in hip-hop, but it's brilliantly written because it feels and sounds so easy. It sounds like anybody could write it until you attempt to write it yourself. And you realize, holy shit, how the fuck did you do that? You know, it's like KRS-One. KRS-One made rap sound a million times more conversational. And that's been the goal over the years, that, you know, from KRS-One to Eminem, and Nas is the guy who's in the middle of that, you know, grouping there, is that these were all rappers that went further and further along the route of making hip-hop sound more and more conversational and away from, if you're walking down the street and you see someone today, you know, like they made it more, you know, you got more words in it, more like how we speak. It's amazing what they've done. And Pac fits in there. He got a lot of words in and a lot of ideas in with a lot of, you know, like, he didn't throw in words that were there just for the rhyme, which is a mistake a lot of rappers do up until this day. You can hear, you know, I mean, it's a style nowadays for a rapper like 2 Chainz or whomever to use the same one word as the rhyme 4 times. You know, long, me and broke don't get along, so-and-so long, and blah, 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 long, and that's clever too. But at the but I mean, like, whoa. Nah, Pac was an amazing MC. Pac was an amazing MC. I wish I met him as a teenager. He would have been someone that I would have gotten along with easily.
Did you ever meet him?
I never met Pac. I never met Pac. What's funny is that my best friend, my son's godfather, is Wood Harris. And I met Wood in 94 because he was at grad school at NYU with me, a year above me. And he had gotten in trouble in grad school that year or the year before in 93 because he took time off to shoot Above the Rim with Pop.
And so you met him after that.
So I met him right after that. And so I'm full of Pop stories. Like my son's mother, Fatima Robinson, is the choreographer that, you know, did California Love and was great friends with Pop as well. I'm surrounded by people who were really close to Pop. But me, no, I never met him.
Did you, we don't have that much time, but I'm curious, knowing that kind of firsthand stuff, preparing for the role and preparing to do the show, did you like go around and collect stories, or did you think like, I don't want to make this too much about him as a person? Like,
no, Pac as a person, I felt like I have a working knowledge of that. It wasn't about that for me, you know? There is no Tupac character in the play, and I never felt like I was playing Tupac. It's funny because even, you know, talking to Pac's mother day before yesterday after the show, and she was like, when you did Holler If You Hear Me, she was like, maybe you'll become Saul again when you go home, but my son's spirit entered your body, and you were my son. I saw my son on stage. I saw and heard my son. You were my son. And his cousin said the same thing to me, like, yo, I saw Pac's spirit in you. I saw in your eyes. I saw, but me on stage, I have never at one moment considered myself portraying Pac. I've just looked like I would any character at the circumstances surrounding this character's life and worked to bring that to life.
Yeah.
And so, no, I did watch interviews and stuff only because I love hearing Pac speak. I love how clear and articulate he is. I love his analogies, like when he, you know, compares, he makes a nice analogy with Romeo and Juliet, you know, the idea of it being a woman, you know, whose family are Bloods and Romeo coming from a family of Crips. I love that analogy. I love when he talks about, you know, that moment where he's like talking about people being hungry. And trying to sing for food, and you're outside. He's in a hotel room giving it an interview, and he's like saying, you know, if I know that there's food, and we all know that there's food in this room, and they're throwing salami and all this food around like crazy in this room, and we're standing outside the door, hungry, trying to sing our way in. It makes sense that, you know, after, you know, at one point we're going to be outside going, you know, we are hungry. Can you please give us some food? You know, and in a year's time, the song is going to change to like, we want food, we need food, please, got to give it, you know. He's like, and it makes sense that 10 years later, that same song is going to be like, I'm picking the lock, pushing through the door, blasting. You know what I'm saying? And I love how he was able to express how the chronology and evolution of music and the mind states within the music speak to, you know, the urgency of the times.
I wanted to ask you something you brought up about, you know, people seeing the number that NZAC won, the Holler If You Hear Me, and saying, that's Pac, you know. I kind of seeing the show, one thing I was amazed at is that you're able to say his words to his music in more or less his rhythm, and it doesn't sound like him. It sounds like you. And I wanted your thoughts about that, how you keep yourself when, you know, singing, you know, generally there's like a little more leeway given for like interpreting a song.
I'm an actor first, you know? I really come from the theater. And so, like, it's cool that, you know, I never dreamt of writing my first film, you know? Like, even when I was conceptualizing the Jesus Christ Superstar thing, I was thinking of writing that thing, you know? But I never thought that, like, my first project, Slam, would be a film that I co-wrote. And I stopped dreaming of myself as a rapper when I was 16 because I thought I was too old. I was just like, fuck it, I'm too old. So I say that to say that I on stage, I spent a lot of time interpreting other writers' work, other writers' material. It's partially, you know, what it served to inform me as a writer is the amount of time I had to spend, you know, breaking down, you know, the work of Athel Fugard or Eugene O'Neill or Shakespeare or Sam Shepard into beats and learning, you know, the details of what's being said and what's under what's being said and all that. And that's the same exact thing that I did in this process. So that, like I said, my goal would never be to sound like Pac, but my writing as a rapper and poet has definitely informed me to the point where when I read Pac, I have a really large appreciation for like what must have gone into writing this verse or this song or what have you. And when I'm interpreting it on stage, I really have, you know, no other goal except to bring it to life, you know, and I'm gonna sound like me because I am, you know, but you know, it's the same thing if I'm interpreting a Rimbaud or Ginsberg poem. I'm not necessarily gonna have the audacity to think, ah, he could have done it better like this. I feel like the understanding, my highest understanding, comes from understanding why they did it and placed the words exactly where they did. So that has to go with my investigation, just like if I were, you know, studying Sufism or being a dervish, a whirling dervish, you know, there are specific mudras and hand positions that you hold in order to invoke the spirit. And so I'm not trying to reinterpret those hand positions. I'm actually trying to achieve those hand positions so that I can see what the fuck they're talking about.
Wow. Well, talking to you the day before opening day, so best of luck.
Thank you.
I saw the show in previews. I'll be seeing it again soon.
Cool. And,
thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you, man.
Spend with us.
Thank you.
That was our interview with Saul Williams, star of Holler If You Hear Me, now on Broadway. Join us next week when we talk to the show's writer, playwright, and dramaturg Todd Creedler. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
And I ain't mad at you.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And I ain't mad at you.
Our invaluable recordist and intern is Julia Hannafin.
And I ain't mad at you.
Our music is by Psionic.
And I ain't mad at you.
Make sure to join us in 2 weeks when we talk more about Holler If You Hear Me, with playwright Todd Creedler. We'll see you then, Outside the Lines. Okay. Oh, wow, they got chairs out front and all that.
Yeah.